Stars Over Surrey with Dave Gemmatis and John Axtell from the Guildford Astronomical Society.
Welcome, John. We're going to talk about the world of spaceflight and astronomy, your constellation of the month, what to look for in the night sky next month, and events at local astronomy societies. But first of all, what's happening in spaceflight and astronomy then, John?
Hello, Dave. Well, we always talk about SpaceX at some point in the programme, so why not start with them? They've just launched one of their Falcon 9 rockets, taking Bangladesh's first communication satellite into orbit, and that was launched from Florida. Now, that's not particularly spectacular in its own right, except that it was their ninth flight this year, and the booster was recovered on a barge at sea, and it was the company's 25th successful such landing. What is interesting about this particular launch is that it was the very first one of the latest version of the Falcon 9, which is called Block 5. So that puts SpaceX just that little bit closer to launching astronauts for NASA, which are going to use the same Block 5 model that flew a couple of weeks ago. Essentially, the Block 5 version incorporates all of the lessons that they've learnt from all of the previous launches. Slightly increased thrust, stronger landing legs, stronger grade aluminium in the main assembly. And parts that were previously replaced in previous variants before the booster was reflown now don't need to be replaced. So the rocket will just be cleaned and refueled and launched again without that heavy kind of replacement parts. So they claim that without maintenance, this new version of the Falcon is going to fly about 10 times. But with minimum maintenance, then each booster should last for about 100 launches. So that really is bringing down, you know, the costs of launch to low Earth orbit.
That is absolutely staggering, being able to use the same rocket so many times.
Absolutely. So they've been doing this so successfully, but each time, and they have had a couple of failures, there are lessons learnt. And I've mentioned things like they've salvaged from crashed rockets, you know, the titanium steering vanes, things like that. Now, all of this has been part of the learning process, and they now reckon they've got it right. But even now, they've had to admit that NASA are insisting on one slight change to the construction of the helium propellant tanks before they start on the actual crew launch. So that will be on new versions, new rockets built under the Block 5 scheme will have this slightly different slightly different helium storage tank before they launch crews. That's with the Crew Dragon, which is the crewed version of the Dragon resupply vessel, which they've been launching successfully to the International Space Station. The ISS has just received a resupply vessel, bringing up about 7,000 pounds of kit and equipment and goodies, food. But that was the other commercial one, the Cygnus, and that was captured by the remote arm and then docked. Coming up on the space station over the next few weeks, we've got a crew change happening. On the 3rd of June, three of the crew will depart. It's one American, one Russian, and the Japanese cosmonaut will depart and land. And 3 days later, on the 6th of June, then we'll have an American lady astronaut, a Russian cosmonaut, and a European Space Agency astronaut, Alexander Gerst from Germany. That will be his second mission to the International Space Station. So moving out a little bit further in our solar system, Dave, we've got quite a few things to talk about at Mars. Remember last month, of course, we talked about the coming launch of the InSight mission to Mars. That successfully launched at the start of the month on an Atlas V rocket, and it's a 484 million kilometre voyage. But it's not just a NASA mission. There are European-built instruments inside InSight to be placed on the surface of Mars when it gets there. It's going to take 205 days, and it will get there on Monday, the 26th of November. And the way it's going to land is the classic version of a thermal shield will protect the craft during the descent through Mars's very thin atmosphere. Then a parachute will deploy to slow it down even further, and then braking thrusters will slow it down for a very gentle touchdown, it's hoped. A part of Mars that's not been visited before by any of the landers or rovers, Elysium Planitia. It's an equatorial plain, nice and smooth, which is why it's been chosen as an area that won't pose any threat to the spacecraft in terms of rocks that might cause it to tumble over or tip up as it lands. One of InSight's first jobs will be to take panoramic pictures to survey the landing site, as I said, because it's never been explored by past Mars missions. And those are going to be enhanced cameras, similar to those taken to Mars already by Opportunity and Curiosity, but with added colour imagery capability. It's got an 8-foot-long robotic arm on board, and that's going to place the seismometer and heat probe down on the Martian surface next to the lander. That robotic arm was actually built for another Mars mission called Mars Surveyor, but that was cancelled. That was way back in 2001, but they've stored the arm, and so they've been able to reuse it to keep the costs of the mission down to an affordable level. Once it's placed on the surface of Mars, the heat flow and physical properties package is going to hammer a drill down to a depth of 5 metres. Now, it's not going to be a rotating drill. As I said, it's a hammer drill. I'm not sure why that's chosen, but obviously they think it's a better approach. And that job of hammering down to 5 metres is going to take about 6 weeks and roughly 10,000 individual hammer blows. but they'll be pausing as they do it to take heat measurements as they go. So that was a concept developed and made in Germany. So that's InSight. We'll keep our eye on that one, as we do have a special interest in it, of course.
Because you're on board, aren't you, John?
Well, squeezed in very tightly with about 2 million other people.
2 million?
Yes, just our names on a chip. It's a publicity thing by NASA, but it provides a little bit of extra interest, and we'll certainly be following that mission as it approaches Mars and deploys and starts sending some interesting results, I'm sure.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you're our correspondent on the way to Mars. And when you land there, of course, we'll have to do a special outside broadcast.
Am I allowed a spacesuit?
Well, and if you want one.
Okay. John Axtell reporting from the surface of Mars.
Absolutely.
Can't wait. I must watch The Martian again before we do that one.
yes, I better not mention what he lives on.
I don't know what he grows it in. No.
Great fun.
Okay. Now, talking of Mars, there is another NASA mission to Mars called the Mars 2020. That's a rover mission scheduled to launch in July of 2020. Now, they've just decided that they're going to take an extra small craft on board the main rover. It's actually going to be carried in the belly of the rover and then deployed. And that's a helicopter. a Mars helicopter. It's taken 4 years of design and testing to come up with this concept and start the prototype builds. It's a very tiny little thing. The typical NASA description says it's the size of a softball. Now, being English, I've no idea what size a softball is, but I gather that's about 5 inches in diameter. But it only weighs 4 pounds, and it'll have twin counter-rotating blades. Remember, the atmosphere of Mars is very, very thin indeed. And those blades are going to rotate to get enough lift in this very thin atmosphere at about 10 times the rate that a helicopter on Earth would spin at. And that's 3,000 RPM. So the helicopter's going to deploy. It'll be lowered from the rover. As I said, it will be slung under the belly of the rover, lowered onto the surface. The rover will move away and watch, and then the helicopter will take off for a series of flights. But it will be such a tremendous idea to prove the concept of heavier-than-air flight in Mars for future missions. It's going to have solar cells to charge its lithium-ion batteries. It's going to have a heating mechanism to keep it warm, through the very cold Martian night times. One of the things to remember is that helicopters here on Earth can only fly up to about 40,000 feet. So when it gets to our craft gets to Mars and tries to fly there, it's already at the equivalent height on Earth of 100,000 feet, much higher than anything has ever flown of a rotor wing type. So that's why it's got this exceedingly fast revolutions to try and give it enough lift. So they had to make it as light as possible whilst being strong, as powerful as it possibly can be. So that will be a fascinating experiment, and hope for the future deployment of similar craft when other missions get to Mars. Whilst on Mars, I mentioned Curiosity already. Curiosity has just used its own drill, a robotic drill. This one is a rotating classic drill, but it's used it for the first time in over the year. It had actually stopped working because of a problem that had developed, but engineers have found a way of circumventing that problem and to get it back working. It's on its way up Mount Sharp. So to test it, they realised that the best place to test it was somewhere that they'd already passed. So it had to retrace its path back to a rock, and it drilled a 2-inch deep hole to collect samples for its onboard laboratory analysis equipment. Still at Mars, listeners may know that we have the theory about our own moon is that there was a protoplanet in the early days of the solar system that collided with Earth, whilst the Earth was still relatively molten. All the junk that came out from that collision went into orbit around what was left of the Earth and the remnants of whatever collided with it, and all of that material coalesced into what is now our moon. Now, is this the same sort of thing that maybe has caused other moons to exist elsewhere in the solar system? And they now believe that this is true, in a sense, for Mars. Mars has two exceedingly tiny moons, Phobos and Deimos. Given that Mars is the god of war, these are the dogs of war, according to Greek and Roman mythology. So it's a much smaller scale, though, than that giant impact that I've described for the Earth-Moon system. But they believe that something the size of a small asteroid will have maybe the size of Vesta, one, I say small asteroid, I should have said one of our biggest asteroids, but an asteroid hitting the red planet threw up a couple of pieces of ejecta that were captured in orbit. Their path and their velocity just meant that it matched Mars's gravitational pull, and so they stayed in orbit rather than flying off or falling back down onto the surface. So they've been doing an awful lot of modelling of this, and they now believe that this is indeed what has happened, you know, probably somewhere 4.5 billion years ago. Mars's diameter is only about twice that of our moon, so the gravitational pull is fairly low. So they've worked out what kind of impactor and what kind of speed would have resulted in these two moons staying in orbit. When I say they're tiny, the biggest one is only 14 miles across and the other one is 7.5 miles across. There have been theories that they were perhaps asteroids that had been captured, or of course the conspiracy guys are out there saying maybe these are alien spacecraft and so on, but close images taken by various Mars missions have just shown them to be chunks of rock. But all of this knowledge is going to be important for the Japan's Mars Moons Mission Exploration, MMX, which is planned to be launched in 2024. So that's going to visit the two Martian moons. One of them is and it's going to land on the surface of one of them, Phobos, and collect a surface sample, which will be returned to Earth in 2029. Let's hope the program is still going strong by then. Then we could report. Now, I've mentioned asteroids a couple of times. You may remember, Dave, that a little while ago I talked about our first interstellar asteroid, known as Oumuamua, the first to arrive from afar, one that came from another solar system, very fast through our solar system, and is now on its way out of our solar system, having had its path changed by interacting with the gravitational effect of our sun. Now, we've now discovered a second interstellar asteroid, or what is believed to be, except this one isn't just passing through our solar system, it's actually now part of our solar system. Our asteroids mostly orbit in a belt between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter, but there are some that are actually in little clusters within the orbit of Jupiter as well, a little bit ahead, a little bit behind, and so on. Now, it's an asteroid that's at the same distance as Jupiter that has been puzzling people, because everything in the solar system goes round the sun in exactly the same direction. This one doesn't. It goes the opposite way round. Now, how can that be? But they've worked out that it must have been something like Oumuamua passing into our solar system. And I said that one's path was bent by the sun. So this one just happened to have its path bent in such a way that it stayed within the solar system, somewhere, as I say, out near the orbit of Jupiter. So maybe some of our asteroids that have been flung out have ended up in other solar systems. You don't know. We have discovered, talking of unusual asteroids, I said our asteroids tend to predominate within the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter, but much further out in the solar system is a place called the Kuiper Belt, which is essentially made up of snowballs, comets. It's the place where most of our comets come from. It's parts of the protoplanetary disk that orbited, that coalesced out of a dust cloud when the sun was formed and have remained in orbit. But they're predominantly made of water, gas, ices, and so on. And we have large Kuiper belt objects out there, such as Pluto. We once thought it was a small planet, but there are several other things of almost the same size as Pluto out there. So they're now just called dwarf planets or Kuiper belt objects. As I said, most of them are made of ice, but they've now just discovered one of them that's actually made of rock, the same kind of rock that our main asteroids between Mars and Jupiter are formed of. So it's thought that particular one, which has got the name 2004 EW95, it's carbon-rich, rocky, carbon-rich, is probably an asteroid from our normal asteroid belt that has perhaps interacted with the gravitational pull of Jupiter and been flung out, perhaps then interacting, depending on the lineup of the other remaining outer planets, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, and has ended up in a stable orbit in the Kuiper belt. So that's another recent first. Now, talking of Uranus, and I do have to be careful how I pronounce this, Uranus smells. We now know this to be true. The gas giants of Jupiter and Saturn are primarily made up of hydrogen, helium, but with ammonia, methane, things of that sort. The ice giants of Uranus and Neptune have much less of those gases. Still have hydrogen, helium, but different kind of compositions. What has just been found in Uranus's atmosphere is hydrogen sulfide, you know, the kind of gas that we get out of stink bombs and so on, that we all had great fun with as horrible little boys and so on. Now, it's the first time that something like that has been discovered in the gas atmosphere of any of the planets in the solar system. So, as I say, ammonia can be found in Jupiter and Saturn, but no hydrogen sulfide. So the fact that gas has been discovered does raise questions about how it has formed and may start people thinking about differences in formation and history between the outer ice giants of Uranus and Neptune and the gas giants of Saturn and Jupiter. Now, I suppose we ought to return to the centre of our solar system now, the Sun. It's been known for a long time that the Sun has a cycle, 11 years. Sunspots reach a maximum where the just north and south of the equator of the Sun maximum it's spattered with sunspots, but then over an 11-year period these disappear, fewer or none are formed. Each I shouldn't give the impression that those sunspots last for 11 years. What I mean is sunspots form and disappear, usually in the course of a fortnight to a month, but they keep doing that at maximum. But then at minimum, none are produced. We can have longer gaps, as happened during the 17th century, something called the Maunder minimum. But what's happening at the moment is that the Sun's sunspots seem to be disappearing towards minimum faster than scientists expect. We had a maximum of in 2012-2015, and that is the weakest maximum that we've had for a long, long time. And the 2008-2009 minimum was unusually long. So now that the sunspots seem to be disappearing faster than we would expect towards a minimum, they're wondering about what this means in terms of change in the sunspot cycle. So we're continually learning. The implications for us are that As we get different sorts of radiation coming from the sun, the Earth's upper atmosphere cools and shrinks. That means that more space junk can accumulate, because if the atmosphere is getting thinner or lower, then it's not interacting with space junk and causing it to burn up. So more risk to things like the International Space Station. But also cosmic rays can alter the chemistry of the Earth's upper atmosphere, seeding clouds, triggering lightning, and also, of course, penetrating aeroplanes. Passengers on long commercial flights get a dose similar to what you get in a dental x-ray. So every time you take a long flight, it's the equivalent of having an x-ray survey at your dentist. So that means that pilots do have to watch their health and have to be monitored. They're now classed as occupational radiation workers because of the number of flights they make per year. Okay, let's move on. We've talked about our sun. How about 1.7 billion suns? These are the stars that have just had their positions accurately measured in the most detailed way by the European Space Agency's Gaia mission. We've just had its second release of data. Its first release of data in 2016 measured about 2 million stars. Gaia was launched in December 2013 and carries an incredibly sensitive chip built in the UK, camera chip, which is used to measure exceedingly small distances. It could, for example, measure from one side of a human hair in New York from London. Or another another way of putting it, that European Space Agency say, being good Europeans, they say it's the equivalent to an earthbound observer resolving a euro coin, a 1 euro coin on the surface of the moon. That's incredible accuracy. So they're using this incredible accuracy to measure exact positions and distances and also relative motions of 1.7 billion stars in our Milky Way. So it includes not just stars, but also the positions of some 14,000 asteroids, and outside the Milky Way, globular clusters orbiting the Milky Way, and also some of the dwarf galaxies that are satellites to our Milky Way. So it's an incredible success for the European Space Agency. So I think that's about it, Dave. That's my report on spaceflight and astronomy news from the last month.
Thank you, John, for the update.
Stars over Surrey, constellation of the month.
So, John, what's the constellation of the month?
Well, Dave, constellation of the month is picking up from where we were last month, which was at Leo, and then moving a little bit further east to one of the brightest stars in the sky, Arcturus, and that's the prime star the alpha star of the constellation Bootis. A couple of nice things to be seen there, and plenty of double stars. So listeners will hear that in the on the video clip supporting the programme. But shall we go ahead and, after that, look at what else is up in the night sky for June?
Absolutely, please.
Okie dokie.
The month ahead for stars over Surrey.
One of my favourite parts of the sky is moving up, which is just a little bit further east of Bootis, and that is the constellations of Hercules and then Lyra. The main reason for that is in Vega you've got some wonderful deep sky objects that I love to watch. That's the Ring Nebula, the remnants of a past explosion of a star throwing off its outer atmospheres. And also, probably my favourite object in the night sky is in Hercules, and that's the M13 globular cluster. So there's some good, interesting parts of the sky coming up in terms of objects. But in terms of the moon, best time to be looking at for the dark sky objects is around the 13th of the month, which is new moon. For looking at the moon itself, I would recommend around the first quarter, which is on the 20th. So 2 or 3 days either side of the 20th is best. Full moon on the 27th of the month. It's also we're getting some good planets this month as well. Mercury will be an evening apparition, as we call it, this month, best from the middle of the month. It's going to be quite low, though, close to the northwestern horizon, setting about an hour after sunset in the middle of the month, but quite bright at magnitude minus 1.4. It does fade by the end of the month, but is setting a little bit later, an hour and a half hours after sunset. Venus is dominating the western sky at sunset. It's at magnitude minus 3.9. And that sets at 3.5 hours after sunset. So look in the west, and the west-northwest, and the bright object looks like a star is in fact the planet Venus. Mars is becoming an evening object, but still best seen in the early hours, but getting brighter and getting bigger as it draws nearer to the Earth. So it increases in magnitude from magnitude minus 1.3 to minus 2.2. So it's getting up to be about as bright as Jupiter is. And Jupiter is still easily seen in the evening sky in the south, late evening, and still there into the early hours. But moving, of course, to the west as the evening goes on. Saturn is also around. That's best seen around midnight, low in the southern sky. That's at Mag Zero. So not that bright. It is further away, obviously, but its rings are nicely open. So even a pair of binoculars will show it not as a dot, but as a more oval shape. With very big binoculars or a small telescope, you can resolve that oval shape into the planet and the rings nicely open around that planet. Uranus and Neptune, not easily seen this month. In terms of events of interest, and to help you to find these planets, we often use the Moon. So the Moon is just 1 degree from Saturn at midnight on the 1st. If you want to find Mars, not quite sure where to look, then on between the 3rd and the 5th, then the gibbous moon is quite close to Mars just before dawn. on the 16th, Venus and the crescent moon will make a nice sight, 6 degrees away, so that's a little distance, but it still make a nice sight in a camera viewfinder, so worth trying for a picture. The 21st is the summer solstice. I'm not suggesting we go out and do pagan ceremonies for that, but it just means that we're in the middle of the summer and the nights can start drawing in and we'll start getting darker skies, which is good for us astronomers. So on the 28th, Saturn will again be quite close to the moon, just about a degree from the full moon in the early hours of the 28th. Something else to look for, though, throughout the month. If you've got a good horizon or a good view of the horizon in the northwest, then from about an hour and a half to 2 hours after sunset, look for noctilucent clouds. These are exceedingly high clouds. They're called noctilucent, means night shining clouds, and it's ice crystals that form exceedingly high in the atmosphere, often seeded by meteor trails that has fall where meteors of small meteors of dust and so on that have fallen into the atmosphere, burnt up, and their remnants will seed the formation of clouds, these ice crystals. So that you only get them this time of the year, from June to July, when the sun is at an appropriate angle to illuminate them, when the sun is just below the horizon. So as I say, an hour and a half to 2 hours after sunset, just above the northwestern horizon. So let's move on now to some of the events that we will have at local societies. At my own society, Guildford Astronomical Society, we've got a splendid talk on Thursday the 7th of June at 7.30 at the University of Surrey. And it's by Professor Nigel Mason, OBE, and he's from the School of Physical Science, part of the Open University. And the subject is Astrobiology, the Cradle of Life. And he describes his talk by saying, how did life begin on Earth? Is there life elsewhere in the universe? How can we look for it? So those are the three fundamental questions for modern science. In this talk, I will discuss how we are trying to answer them. So that's sounds as though it's going to be a splendid talk. Now, obviously, that's free to members of Guildford Astronomical Society, but visitors can attend as well. There is I think it's a £4 visitor fee, which goes towards paying for the cost of the lecture theatre. So Farnham Astronomical Society, meeting at Aldershot Cricket Club, they've got a speaker I've heard before, Dr. George Seabrook from UCL's Mallard Space Science Laboratory, excellent speaker, and he's talking about one of the things which we mentioned today, Gaia. So his subject on Tuesday the 12th of June is Gaia, Measuring a Billion Stars. Croydon Astronomical Society have two meetings. They haven't released the title as yet on the meeting on the 8th of June at Royal Russell School. But on Friday the 22nd of June, the talk is Space and Spirituality by Bernard Winchester. I think he's addressing some of the experiences of astronauts who, you know, when they, some of the Apollo astronauts particularly have said they've experienced revelations and things of this sort about how they feel about life on Earth and the beyond and so on. So I think he's addressing that topic. Yule Astronomical Society. Meeting at Nonsuch High School for Girls on Friday the 8th of June. It's a similar topic to one we've already mentioned, Gaia again, and the title is An Initial Look at 1.7 Billion Stars in Our Galaxy and Beyond, and that's by a chap from Croydon Astronomical Society, I know quite well, a chap called John Murrell. So he's doing a similar talk to that by George Seabrook at Farnham, but from an amateur's perspective. And for those of you who can't get out to observe or can't get to meetings, then of course we do have astronomy on television. So The Sky at Night, which is on the Sunday the 10th of June and Thursday the 14th of June, repeated both on BBC 4, 10 o'clock and 7:30 respectively. And the title is Jupiter, God of Thunder. Jupiter's Juno spacecraft is currently in orbit around Jupiter, collecting data and revealing the secrets of the stormy gas giant. A month ahead of the probe's planned deorbit into Jupiter's atmosphere, the team looks back on what went on what the Juno mission has revealed so far and what discoveries might yet be to come. And that's it, Dave. That's my look at what's up in the night sky for June.
Before we go, John, Richard Branson's been in the news again trying to drum up free publicity for Virgin Galactic by announcing he's been in training to be an astronaut.
Indeed. They've just had another flight of their suborbital space plane, which was ferried up to about 40,000 feet by the mother plane, which is a twin-boomed affair with the spacecraft slung beneath it. That drops from the mother craft and ignites its rocket boosters, and that flew up to about 115,000 feet, I think, as a test flight with the two crew on board. Remember, this is its second test since the sad fatal accident that was experienced a couple of years ago. So it has set the Virgin Galactic program back a little while, recovering from that. But Richard Branson believes that the next he should be starting flying passengers into not orbit but suborbital hops, so into a weightless environment within a few months, he says. So he has been doing the requisite training. It's not the same level of training for going into zero gravity for something like the International Space Station. But, yeah, I think they want you reasonably fit.
Well, I wish him well and hope it all works and everything.
Absolutely, absolutely.
But I think I'd place a bet on Elon Musk sending postcards back from Mars before Richard Branson gets into orbit.
Absolutely. And it's interesting. I don't know if you're watching the BBC series called Missions, which is on television now. It's actually a French series subtitled into English, but there are two missions to Mars going on at the same time, and both of them are funded by billionaires. They're not national enterprises, and one of them, one of the companies, was called Zed Space, a little bit similar to SpaceX, possibly.
Obviously, a fan of Elon Musk, as we all are.
Indeed.
Well, thank you, John, for the fascinating insight. This show will be repeated on Monday night at 11 p.m. and is available after transmission as a podcast. The podcast will also have more items that we couldn't fit into this broadcast. The next edition of Stars Over Surrey will be on Friday, 29th of June. Goodbye from me and John.
Indeed, goodbye.
Stars Over Surrey with Dave Jemitis and John Axtell from the Guildford Astronomical Society.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, why not keep up to date with the Sound of Surrey by listening live at brooklandsradio.co.uk or through our free mobile app.